Saranga looked away, sneering as though at a younger sister. "I thought it plain," he said. "Two spies were revealed. Two false faces." Sowheel glared. Frustration welled through him, and with an overwhelming urge to simply close his eyes and slump from his saddle. His thoughts sagged, reeled into nonsensical convolutions. The ground looked cushioned soft. He would sleep such a sleep. And his pony, stubborn. Aeschylus could have him. He was strong. Saranga could keep Mebby, and lose the moral high ground to his whining courtiers. The young king was quick in blinking away his foolishness. "Saranga, look at me. Please. I am the enemy of your enemy. He murdered my father." The successor prince pawed his face as though trying to wipe away the exhaustion. "Then why to sow drama, discord between us, to sow discord in my own heart, or a look of flat disgust, or maybe he was mistaken." "What?" Saranga crowed, laughing. "Because he found your soul too subtle? A barbarian? Spare me your lies, shitherder."
No, because...
Saranga mocked. For some reason this barb found its way through the numbness, stung, enough to bring tears to his eyes. "You would think me mad if I told you," the young king of Sarkarpus said, his voice cracking. Saranga gazed at him for a long, expressionless moment. A look of judgment and decision. "I've seen you in battle," he finally said, speaking with a semblance of cruelty that men sometimes use to make room for a friend's momentary weakness. He smiled as best his heart could manage. "I already think you mad." A single teasing accusation, and the rift of suspicion between them was miraculously healed. Often men need only speak around things to come together, and so remember what it means to speak through. Too weary to feel gratified or relieved, Sorweel began telling the successor prince everything that had transpired since the death of his father and the fall of his hallowed city. He told him of the stork who had alighted the walls the instant before the great ordeal attacked his city. He told him how he had wept in the Aspect Emperor's arms. He confessed everything, no matter how shameful, how weak, knowing that for all the aloofness of Saranga's gaze, the man no longer judged him with a simple rule. And then he told him about the slave, Porsperian. He made a face, her face, in the earth. And I swear to you, Saranga, he gathered mud, spit from her lips. He rubbed it across my cheek. "Before the council?" Saranga asked, astonished eyes shining from a dubious scowl. "Before the Anasarimba named you one of the faithful?" "Yes, yes, and ever since. Even Caeudus congratulates me on my turning." "Conversion," Saranga corrected, his head slung low in concentration. "Your conversion." So far the young king of Sarkarpus had spoken through the weariness that hooks lead weights to each and every thought, making the effort of talking akin to that of lifting what would rather sink. Suddenly speaking felt more like trying to submerge air-filled bladders, holding down things that should be drowned.
"Tell me what you think,"
Sowheel cried. "This is bad Rashu, a mother birth for us. She is the slave goddess. Beneath our petition—"
"It does shame me," Sowheel blurted. "I am one of the warlings, born of blood, both ancient and noble, trothed to Gilgale since my fifth summer. She shames me."
"But not beneath our respect," Saranga continued with an air of superstitious concern. Dust had chalked his king's hair, said that he resembled Obutegua, older and wiser than his years. "She is among the eldest, the most powerful.
So what are you saying?"
The successor prince absently stroked his pony's neck rather than answer. Even when hesitating, Saranga possessed a directness. a paradoxical absence of hesitation. He was one of those rare men who always moved in accordance with themselves, as though his soul had been cut and stitched from a single cloth. So unlike the patched motley that was Sorweel's soul. Even when the successor prince doubted, his confidence was absolute. "I think," Saranga said, "and by that I mean I think, that you are what they call Narendari in the Three Seas." His body seemed to sway about the stationary point of his gaze. "Chosen by the gods to kill."
"Kill?" Sorweel cried. "Kill?"
"Yes," the successor prince replied, his green eyes drawn down by the frightful weight of his ruminations. When he looked up, he gazed with a certain blankness, as if loath to dishonor his friend with any outward sign of pity.
"To avenge your father."
Sorweel already knew this, but in the manner of men who have caged their own fears. He knew this as profoundly as he knew anything, and yet somehow he had managed to convince himself it wasn't true. He had been chosen to kill the Aspect Emperor.
"So what am I to do?"
he cried, more honest to his panic than he intended.
"What does she expect of me?"
Zaranga snorted with the humor of the perpetually overmatched.
"What does the mother expect? The gods are children, and we are their toys. Look at you sausages. They cherish us one day, break us the next."
He held out his arms as if to mime mankind's age-old exasperation. "We Zayumi pray to our ancestors for a reason." Sorweel blinked against mutinous eyes.
"Then what do you think I should do?"
"Stand in front of me as much as possible," the handsome successor prince chortled. A better part of Zaranga's strength, Sorweel had learned, lay in his ability to drag good humor out of any circumstance. It was a trait he would try to emulate.
"Look at these past days, Horse King," the black man continued when Sorweel's lack of amusement became clear. "With every throw of the number sticks, you win. First, she disguised you. Now she exalts you with glory in the field, raises you in the eyes of men. Can't you see? You were little more than a foundling when you first joined the Scions. Now old Harney can scarce sneeze without begging your advice."
Zaranga praised him with a kind of cocked wonder.
"She is positioning you, Sorweel."
More truths he had already known, yet refused to acknowledge. Suddenly the young king of Sarkarpus found himself regretting his confession, repenting what was in fact his first true conversation since the death of his father. Suddenly it seemed pathetic and absurd, searching for a brother and a son of Zayum, a nation the Sarkarpi used to refer to things too distant or too strange to be credited.
"What if I don't want to be disguised or positioned?"
Zaranga shook his head with a kind of bemoaning wonder. "You sausages," his eyes said. "We Zayumi pray to our ancestors for a reason." Clouds climbed the horizon, and the men of the Middle North rejoiced, thinking the gods had relented at long last. They sailed across the sky with the grace of whales, ever more crowded, ever more bruised about their bellies. But aside from brief showers of spittle, the rain did not come. A windless humidity rose in its stead, the kind that makes sodden cloth of limbs and lead of burdens. The day ended in weariness and indecision, the same as any other, save that the Zadunyani's exhaustion was total and their unslaked thirst extreme. The absence of dust was their only reprieve. Night brought near absolute darkness. The attack came during the first watch. A Shrank war party, some 20 lances strong, simply leapt out of the blackness and fell upon the Galeoth flank. Men who muttered among themselves to while away the boredom cried out in sudden horror and were no more. The Shrank swept over the outermost sentries, raced caterwauling toward the ranks of the Night Defenders proper. Men locked shields against the blackness, lowered their pikes. Some cursed while others prayed. Then the obscenities were upon them, hacking and howling, their limbs wasted, their stomachs pinned to their spines. Heaving and hewing along the length of their shallow line, the Galeoth held their ground. Crying out hymns, they struck the maniacal creatures down. Horns and alarms rang through the rest of the host. Men raced to their positions, some hopping to pull on their boots, others with their hauberks swinging. Agmundermen, with their war knots, Nangales, with their blue tattooed cheeks, Numeniri, with their great hanging beards, iron-clad men drawn from all the great tribes of Galeoth, Thunyrsis, and Satadon, arrayed across a mile of flats and shallow ravines. They readied themselves with cursing bravado, and then, when every strap was buckled and every shield raised, they peered across the dark plain. Behind their gleaming ranks, the Kidrahil and caste noble knights loitered in mounted clots, many standing in their stirrups to gaze as well. No one saw anything, such was the darkness. During the following watch, news of the Shrank war party's easy defeat circulated through the ranks. The cynics among them predicted weeks of blaring horns and sleepless, pointless vigils. General Caeudus sent out several Kidrahil companies to reconnoiter the plain. The cavalrymen loathed few things more than riding pickets at night, for fear of ambush, certainly, but more for fear of being thrown. Since Sacarpus, some 80 souls had perished ranging the dark, and hundreds more had been injured or crippled. After the judges executed a Kidrahil captain for deliberately laming his ponies to feed his men, the companies were even denied the tradition of feasting on the crippled mounts. The Northmen became complacent, and soon the host boomed with impatient chatter. Several pranksters broke ranks to dance and gesticulate before the pitch-black distances. The thanes could not silence them, no matter how hard they bawled. So when reports of cries heard on the plain reached General Caeudus, he was not immediately inclined to believe them. He summoned his sister, Serwa, only when the first of the scouting parties failed to return. As with the other schools, the Swayali witches had remained largely cloistered within the host. Apart from chance encounters in the camp, the Zadunyani saw them only during the signaling, when one of the Swayali would climb the night sky to flash coded messages to their Sake counterparts in the Army of the East. The reasons for this discretion were manifold. The Swayali were witches, for one. Despite the aspect emperor, many held their old prejudices fast. How could they not, when so many of their words for sorcery and its practitioners were also words for wickedness? They were women, for another. Several men had already been whipped, and one even executed for acting out deranged infatuations. But most importantly, the aspect emperor wished to deny the consult any easy reckoning of the power he brought against them. For in truth, all the men of the ordeal, in their countless shining thousands, were little more than a vehicle for the safe conveyance of the schools. Prince Anasarimber Caeudus decided the time for discretion was at an end. At her brother's command, Serwa deployed her witches behind the common line, holding 43 of the most senior and accomplished in reserve. A profound hush accompanied their appearance throughout the camp. The nuns, the men called them, with their yellow billows, the immense silken gowns they wore as protection against Koray, wrapped and bound about them, the Swayali, indeed, resembled Jokian nuns. Sorcerous utterances cracked the gloom, and one by one the witches stepped into the air. They strode out over the deep ranks of the common line. Men in their thousands craned their necks to follow their soundless course. Some murmured, a few even called out, but most held their breath for wonder. Given the youth of the school, the women were young as well, with faces of smooth alabaster and teak, lips full about the lights that flashed from them. Free of the ground, they unbound their billows, spake the small cant that animated them. The fabric dropped, unfurled in arcs that twined in the glow of the nuns' arcane voices. One by one the Swayali bloomed, open like flowers of golden silk, and the men of the ordeal were dumbstruck. Swayali, the school of witches. They climbed out beyond the common line, a second chevron, like a mathematical apparition of the first. 200 lights flung into the blackness of the plain. They stopped, hung like wickless candlelights. Arcane chanting, eerie and feminine, shrugged away the cavernous heights of the night, and found ears in the form of intimate whispers. Prompted by some inaudible signal, they lit the world in unison. Bars of heaven, lines of blinding white rising from the wasted ground to the shrouded sky, some 200 of them, like silver spokes across the near horizon. Their faces slack above the rims of their shields, the men of the Middle North squinted across a lightning-illuminated world, one devoid of sound, bleached of color. At first, many could not credit their eyes. Many stood blinking, as if trying to awaken. Instead of earth, shrank. Instead of distance, shrank. Fields upon fields of them, creeping on their bellies like worms. They had come as locusts, where the lust of the one sparks the lust of the other until all is plague. They had come, answering a cunning as old as the age of their obscene manufacture. They had come to feast, and they had come to couple, for they knew of no other possibility. The nuns' chanting chorus crumbled into an arcane cacophony. One glowing figure sparked with furious light. Then another. Then all was glare and blinking hell. The air whooshed and cracked, sounds so great that many flinched behind their shields, sounds that blew through the roar of burning shrank. The men of the ordeal stood dazzled. 7 heartbeats fate would grant them. 7 heartbeats to see their foe thrash in the fire of their burning. 7 heartbeats to wonder at the girls hanging alone in the sky, setting the earth alight with glowing song. 7 heartbeats, for even though the beasts died in untold thousands before their eyes, all the world beyond the witches was shrank. And far more creatures heaved and scrambled between the circuits of their sorcerous destruction than within. Arrows chipped at the nuns' wards, a few that quickly became an obscuring rain, until the witches were naught but blue glowing marbles beneath clattering black. Far more missed their mark than otherwise, so that the creatures fell in great arcs below. And the horde howled, a noise so savage, raised in so many ulcerated throats, that many men of the ordeal dropped their weapons to clasp their ears. A cry that pinched the nape of even the bravest man's neck, and sent the very landscape rushing. Not a man who had boasted failed to repent his words. The Swayali seemed to move for the fields of shrank surging beneath them. Many men stumbled for vertigo. Shrieks warbled through the all-encompassing roar. No word that men traded could be heard, no horn that sounded. No drum. But the believer kings had no need of communication. They had but one inviolable order. Yield no ground. Mouthing soundless shouts, the men of the Middle North watched the Cyclopean charge. They saw the ground vanish beneath waves of howling faces. They glimpsed silhouettes against cauldrons of destroying light. Notched blades held high. Figures kicking in starved dog fury. They watched the horde descend upon them. No words, no training could prepare them for the fact of their enemy. Many glanced to the horizon, thinking they could see their holy aspect emperor striding across the back of a shrouded world, not realizing the horde had beset each of the 4 armies, that he battled far away with Proyas and the army of the East. The fleetest among the shrank struck first, a scattering of mad individual assaults, They crawled and thrashed like cats thrown from rooftops. But the men scarcely noticed them, such was the deluge that followed. The scrambling herd of limbs, the flying line of blades and axes, the crazed white faces, those intense startling for their inhuman beauty, those that shrieked appalling for their infernal deformity. Glimpses rimmed in the light of Swayali destruction. Stick-limbed apparitions. The men of the Middle North raised their shields and spears against them. So did the Horde crash against the army of the Middle North. The dead could scarce fall, so packed, so violent was the melee. Men grimacing and thrusting panic. Non-man faces squealing and snapping. Shrank, crushed by the heave of their countless brothers. Shrank, their every bestial instinct bent to ferocity. Men cringed from their eye-blink speed, gasped against their gut-twisting stink, the rod of fishmongers clothed in fecal rags. But the shining men stood their stubborn ground, heavily armored, stout of heart, and mighty of limb. They knew that flight would be their destruction. Torrents of arrows and javelins blackened the deranged vista, falling upon the ranks in a soundless clatter. But only those foolish enough to raise their faces were wounded or killed. Heeding the lessons of the ancients, they fought in deep phalanxes, arrayed so that those forward could brace their backs or shoulders against the shields of those behind, so that the entire formation must be clawed like a burr from the world's hair before moving. The Galeoth and Tidoni wielded their thrusting spears, and Nansuri, short swords designed for close-quarters fighting, to great effect, stabbing at the abominations pinioned against their shields. The Thunieri, who were weaned on the blood of Shrank, used hatchets long favored by their fathers. The host's bowmen maintained their positions immediately behind the common line, loosing shaft after shaft on shallow arcs over the heads of their countrymen. All of them, even the famed Agmunderman, fired blind, knowing their arrows killed, yet despairing the insignificance of their toll. For the knights and thanes stranded on their ponies behind the common line, it seemed a kind of mad performance, like those staged by the great troops of dancers who frequented the courts of kings. For weeks they had skirmished with the Shrank, had grinned the pulse-pounding grin of the chase and kill. But now they could only watch in astonished frustration, for the Shrank had swallowed the very ground they would ride. Hundreds abandoned their mounts, hoping to shoulder their way to the fore of their men-at-arms, but the judges stayed them with threats of doom and damnation, reminded them of the Aspect Emperor and his martial prohibitions. For each phalanx was a kind of abacus, and each man a bead, bound by strict rules of substitution. Earl Hyrengar of Canute spurned the judges. He was one of those belligerent souls who could not abide watching while his lessers fought, let alone consider the consequences of his acts. When the judges tried to seize him, he killed two and grievously injured a third. Then, because no signal could be heard above the clamor, he rode unopposed into the phalanx of his countrymen, with his thanes in grim tow. His company managed to hack their way some 30 yards beyond the common line. Great-bearded Tidoni, their mouths howling, inaudible war cries, their swords and axes swinging on wild arcs. But the Shrank engulfed them, climbed the backs of their brothers, leapt to tackle the hapless knights. Hyrengar himself was dragged from his saddle by the beard. Death came swirling down. Dismayed and disorganized, his kinsmen faltered. But even as panic leapt like wildfire among them, four nuns floated above, their billows flaring golden, their sorcerous mutter fluting through the ringing deafness. Hanging as high as treetops, they decimated the Shrank with scythes of crackling light, and so provided the Canutish men a desperate respite. Whenever men faltered, the Swayali witches were there above them, with their silk billows cupping the light of their dread dispensations, glowing like jellyfish in the deep. their mouths flashing lanterns, their hands working looms of killing incandescence. After the initial shock, the men of the Middle North embraced their training, realizing with a kind of wonder that this was what they had prepared for all along. How to yield 10 paces whenever the dead piled too high, how to draw their own wounded and dead through their line, even how to fight the sky, for in their frenzy, the Shrank would claw across the backs and shoulders of their brothers and leap over the forward ranks. Battle became a kind of dread harvest. Shrank died burning, Shrank died punctured and trampled, Shrank died scratching at shields. Yet they came, and they came, surging beneath the witches and their comb of brilliant destruction, a shrieking chorus that wetted ears with blood. Men who faltered for exhaustion rotated, with men from the rearward ranks. Soon gored figures could be seen stumbling behind the common lines, crying out for water, for bandages, or simply crashing to the dust. The judges paced the line, their gilded circumfixes held high, their mouths working about exhortations no one could hear. Hell itself seemed to churn out but a keel away. And they wondered that mere men could hold such wickedness at bay. And then slowly, inexorably, a different sound climbed into the deafening clamor. A more human intonation, tentative at first, but constant in its slow swelling. Singing. The shining men crying out, rank upon rank, nation upon nation, until every soul bellowed in miraculous unison, a shout that climbed high upon the back of the horde's bedlam roar. The beggar's lament. I have boils like little titties, I have feet like stumps of beef. And the men of the Middle North began laughing as they hacked and hewed, weeping for the joy of destruction. Every coin that falls from me gets snatched by another thief. The same lyric hollered out over and over, like a sacred intonation. It became a banner, a scrap of purity hoisted high above a polluted world, and none would relinquish it. A call and a promise, a curse and a prayer. And the shining men matched the Shrank and their preternatural fury, roared singing as they stove skulls and spilled entrails. In one mad voice they fumbled for their faith, raised high the shield of their belief, and became unconquerable. The scions fled across the black, the earth little more than liquid shadows sweeping beneath. Sorweel continually found himself sagging to his right. Such was his exhaustion. His eyes would roll between pasty blinks, and his head would lull, like a tipping weight. The dark world would tilt, and for a heartbeat, he would float on the border of unconsciousness, before catching himself with a panic jerk. At the very least, his pony, stubborn, remained true to his moniker, and showed no sign of faltering. Periodically he would shout mock encouragement to Zaranga, who would always reply by wishing him ill. Neither paid attention to what was said. The saying was all that mattered. The reminder that other souls endured the same congealed misery, and somehow persevered. Finally, after days of tacking across the wastes, they had flanked and outdistanced the 10 yoke legion, though they had been reduced to 15 mounted souls doing so. Now, with their last sip of strength, they raced toward the smear of flickering lights on the horizon. What they would have thought a thunderstorm, were it not for the tin-distant clamor. They could hear it over the broken percussion of hooves tumbling across the dust, over the pinched complaints of their ponies. A sound, high and hollow, ringing as if the world were a cistern. It was a sound that grew and grew, impossibly, they realized, guessing the distance of its origin. Pruning like a thousand wolves, hacking like warring geese. An immeasurable sound, or at least one beyond men and their mortal rule. The Horde. A sound so titanic that Harnilas, for all his ruthless determination to reach General Caiudas, called the ragged company to a halt. The Scions sat rigid in their saddles, squinting at their shadowy companions, waiting for the dust to outrun them. Solwheel peered ahead, struggling to make sense of the flash and flicker that now extended across a good swath of the horizon. He looked at Zaranga, but the man hung his head, grimacing and thumbing his eyes. At the captain's bidding, Aeschylus cast another of his sorcerous lenses. The light of his incantation seemed a jewel, so dark the world had become. Sorwheel glimpsed the others, their faces drawn and gaunt, eyes bruised with the sorrow and fury that is manhood. Then soundless images crowded the air before the schoolmen. The Scions gasped and cried out, even those too exhausted to speak. A screeching world, heaving, howling masses, pale and silvery like fish schooling through dark waters. Shrank, raving and thronging, so many as to seem singular, they're rushing like the slow curl of scarves warring across the horizon. The men of the Middle North could be barely glimpsed, arrayed in bristling, segmented bars, defending barricades of stacked carcasses. Only the Swayali witches could be clearly seen, hanging like slips of gold foil, drawing skirts of flashing Gnostic destruction. Never enough. With twists of his fingers, Aeschylus turned the lens on a shallow arc, revealing more and more of the madness that awaited them. For all its power and the glory, the army of the Middle North was but a shallow island in dark, heaving seas. No one need speak the obvious. The Northmen were doomed. Real, Sorwheel once again found himself thinking in dumb wonder. His war is real. He turned from the spectacle to the schoolmen, saw the ribs of his ailing pony carved in light and shadow. "A sight for my dreams," Aeschylus murmured, and Sorwheel worried for the brittle cast of his eyes, the promise of panic. Without thinking, he reached out to squeeze the man's round shoulder in reassurance, the way King Harwheel might. "Remember," he said, speaking the words he suddenly wanted to believe, "this time the god marches with us."
"Yes," the square-bearded sorcerer replied with a throat-clearing harumph. Of course. And then they heard it, like an echo floating through howling winds. Human voices, shouting out human sounds, hope, fury, and defiance. Defiance most of all. "The beggar's lament," someone called from behind them. "The crazy bastards!"
And with that, they all could hear it, word for hoarse word, a drinking song bellowed out to the heavens. Suddenly the throat-picking frailty fell away from the distant men, and what had seemed a vision of doom became legendary, glorious, more indomitable than overmatched. The gored Northmen, their lines unbroken, reaving. A massacre of the mad many by the holy few. That was when they heard another sound, another ear-scratching roar, one that came shivering through the dark and dust and grasses. More shrank behind them. A miraculous slaughter, on a scale too demented to be celebrated. Caiudas and his believer kings knew their flanks would be quickly enveloped. But they also knew, thanks to the ancients, that their encircling would be the product of happenstance, a consequence of the shrank and their mobbing desperation. Whipped by their lunatic hunger, each simply ran toward men, and their porcine smell a course continually deflected by the mobbing of their brothers before them. In this way the horde spilled ever outward like water chasing gutters. But the process was such that those who reached the ends of the Galeoth flanks would be but trickles compared with the torrents above.
"The horde will strike the way a nonny courtesans pile their hair," Caeudus had explained to his laughing commanders. "Locks will spill down our cheeks, make no mistake, but only a few curls will tickle our chin."
And so was the ignominious task of defending the camp and rear delegated to the lords of the great ordeal. So-called cornice phalanxes occupied the ends of the common line, formations of courageous souls trained to battle in all directions. Triunes of Swayali hung above, scourging the endless flurries of shrank that sluiced around them. And with the Kidrahil, the assembled thanes and knights policed the darkling plains between. If the Prince Imperial's descriptions had led them to expectations of easy slaughter, they were quickly disabused. Many were lost to the mundane treachery of burrows and ant-mounds. Earl Arcaster of Geishendal, a man renowned for his ferocity in battle, broke his neck before he and his Galeoth knights encountered a single shrank. Otherwise all was darkness and racing madness, conditions that favored the lust-maddened shrank clans. Companies would ride down one cohort in effortless slaughter, only to be surprised by the shrieking assault of another. Company after company limped back to the precincts of the camp, their numbers decimated, their eyes vacant with vicious horrors. Lord Siklar of Angansinor, cousin of King Hogrum, would be felled by a stray arrow out of nowhere. Lord Hingith of Gainry would fall in pitched battle with his entire household, as would Lord Ganrica, veteran of the First Holy War, a name that would be mourned by many. And so death came swirling ever down. Despite the toll, not one of the obscenities lived to trod the alleys of the darkened camp. Fleeing into a world illumined by faraway sorcery, riding as if chased by the world's own crumbling edge, gouged hollow, a stack of tin about a papyrus fire, light enough to be blown by terror, dull and heavy enough to die, to tumble dirt against dirt. The intellect overthrown, the eyes rolling, seeking non-existent lines, as if trying to peer around the doom encircling them. Stubborn coursed beneath him, galloping like a dog across invisible earth, scoring the thirsty turf. Saranga glanced at him, sobs kicking through the monkey terror of his grin. The others were less than shadows. A world flew in shreds beneath them, and the whole was delivered to Shrank. The Ten Yoke Legion. A shriek, a sound heard only for its humanity, and the Scions were 14. "They would drive them the way we drive slaves in the Three Seas," the schoolman had said. "Starve them until their hungers reached a fever pitch. Then, when they have reached a position where the shrank could smell mannish blood on the wind, they would strike the chains and let them run." Sorweel tossed a panic glance over his shoulder toward the inscrutable black that gnashed and grunted behind them, saw Escalies yanked to earth on the back of his tumbling pony, slapped like a fish onto the gutting table. And he was reining, crying out to Zaranga, leaping to the turf, sprinting to the motionless schoolman. The Scions were nothing but streamers of fading dust. He gasped shrieking air, skidded to a halt. He heaved the sorcerer onto his back, cried out something he could not hear. He looked up, felt more than saw the rush, raving and inhuman. And for a heartbeat, he smiled. A king of the horse lords, dying for a lunaral. One last humiliation. The beasts surfaced, as if looking back had become looking down. Faces of pale silk crushed into expressions both crazed and licentious, slicked weapons,
glimpses piled upon glimpses, terror upon terror. Sorweel looked to them, smiling even as his body tensed against hacking iron. He watched the nearest leap, only to crash into a film of incandescent blue, sorcery, wrapped into a hemisphere about them. The booming roar swept into them, over them, and Sorweel found himself in a mad bubble, a miraculous grotto where sweat could be wiped from sodden brows. Sand and dust shivered and danced between leather threads of grass. Beyond howling faces, horned weapons and knobbed fists crowded his every glimpse. He watched with a kind of disemboweled wonder. The white rope limbs, the teeth like broken cockery shells, the covetous glitter of innumerable black eyes. Breathing required will. Aeschylus thrashed his way back to blubbering consciousness. Moaning, he threw his gaze this way and that, flailed with his fists. Sorweel hugged his shoulders, tried to wrestle the panic from him. He thrust the portly man back, pinned him, crying, "Look at me! Look at me!" "No!" the man howled from his dust-white beard. Urine blackened the man's trousers. "Something!" Sorweel cried through the scratching, pounding racket. The heave of crazed wretches encompassed everything. The first luminous cracks scrawled across the ward, wandering like the flight of flies. "You have to do something!" "It's happening. Sweet Seju. Sweet... sweet..." Sorweel cuffed him full on the mouth. "Aeschylus, you have to do something. Something with light!" The mandate schoolman squinted in confusion. "The ordeal, you fat fool! The ordeal needs to be warned!" Somehow, somewhere in Sorweel's cry, the sorcerer seemed to encounter himself. The stranger who had sacrificed all in the name of his aspect emperor. The Zarunyani. The believer. His eyes found their focus. He reached out to squeeze the young king's shoulder in assurance.
"Light," he gasped. "Light! Yes!"
He pressed Sorweel to the side, tottered to his feet, even as his incipient ward began to crumble. The glow of his chanting gleamed across swatches of madness. Screeching faces, jerking, trembling like strings in the wind. Bleeding gums, diseased skin, weeping slime and algae. Notched edges flying on arcs both cramped and vicious. Eyes of glittering black, hundreds of them, fixing them, weeping and raging for hunger. Lips shining for slaver. Like a nightmare. Like a mad fresco depicting the living gut of hell. Bleached ever wider for the brilliance of the schoolman's unholy song. Words too greased to be caught and subdued by the legion's vicious roar. Echoing through invisible canyons. And there it was, striking as straight as a geometer's line, from the ground at the fat sorcerer's feet, dazzling the eyes, stilling the inhuman onlookers with salt-white astonishment, reaching high to illuminate the belly of the overcast night. A bar of heaven. General Caeudus was the first to glimpse it across the tumult. The northmen but rafts of discipline in a tossed sea of shrank. The Swayali like columns of sunlight, breaking through tempest clouds, burning the inexhaustible waters. He saw it, between pelting arcs of arrows, a needle of glittering white on the southern horizon, where nothing but dead earth should be. He turned to his sister, who had followed his gaze out to the distant and inexplicable beacon. Others in his cortege noticed also, but their shouts of alarm were soundless in the thrumming roar. Sirwa need only glimpse her brother's lips to understand. They were children of the Dunyane. She stepped into the sky, summoned the nearest of her sisters to rise with her. The world smelled of burning snakes. Sorweel saw clouds knotted in woolen plates, flickering in and out of edgeless illumination.
His head lulled, and he saw the earth reeling, pricked with infinite detail. A thousand, thousand mortal struggles. Iron-clad men hacking and hollering. Shrank, and more shrank, twitching and innumerable. He saw women hanging in the air with him, far-gowned Swahili, singing impossible incandescent songs. Then he jerked his lurching gaze to the hook that had lifted him so high. A goddess held him, carried him like a child across the surfaces of hell.
"Mother?"
he gasped, thinking not of the woman who had borne him, but of the divinity, Yatwar, the mother of wombs, who had cursed him with murdering the most deadly man to ever walk her parched earth.
"No," the glorious lips replied. It seemed a miracle that she could hear him, such was his guttural clamor. A roar so knotted with violence that the very air seemed to bleed.
"Worse."
"You!"
he gasped, recognizing the woman through the fiery veil of her beauty.
"Me,"
Anasarimba Sirwo replied, smiling with the cruelty of the peerless.
"How many hundreds will die," she asked, "for saving you?"
"Drop me then," he croaked. She recoiled from the floating fury of his gaze, looked out across the threshing darkness, frowning, as if finally understanding she bore a king in her arcane embrace. Through acrid veils of smoke, he breathed deep the scent of her. The myrrh of glory and privilege. The salt of exertion.
"Let me fall,"